Well, today we want to continue to overview things that are impacting the end times, and I want to talk about the whole issue of oil and the Middle East today. Control the world oil supply. Look at the nations that are on this list and ask yourself how many of them are friends of Israel. How many of them are friends of the United States? This is the top eight nations who control the world oil supply. By the way, the United States is 11th. Does not make the top 10 list. But the United States would be farther down in terms of oil-producing nations. Now, this is just the oil reserves that these nations have. We're not being permitted to produce a lot of the oil we have. I mean, that was a major issue in the last campaign. I think we're all aware of that. It's interesting that President Bush got chewed up and spit out for the high gasoline prices. And the minute he authorized offshore drilling, the gasoline prices started to fall and down to the levels they're at now. You think he got a word of credit for it? No. He got all the blame, but he didn't get any of the credit for the correction. Because I don't know about you, but $1.75 a gallon's helping me out a whole lot. That $4 stuff was killing me. And this $1.75 has made a big impact on my situation. And so thank you, President Bush, for your work on that. And I feel bad he got all the blame but none of the credit when the situation was improving. We've got Saudi Arabia. They've always been the leader in oil reserves, 264.3 billion barrels. These figures are as of 2008. Then right behind them, a nation that I don't like to see high up on that list, Iran. The Bible has a lot to say about Iran in the last days. We've looked at some of that. None of it's good. None of it's good. It's called Persia back in Bible days. It's the same nation. Then you have Iraq. And though our troops are there, though we've removed Saddam Hussein, if anybody thinks that Iraq is going to end up being a nation that's friendly to the United States, you're kidding yourself. And the reason for that is it's a nation that's too dominated by Islam. And Islam is a religion that hates Israel, and it's a religion that hates the West. And so there's absolutely no way that Iraq can end up standing with us when push comes to shove on the issue of Israel. Kuwait, for the moment, a friendly nation because we kicked Saddam Hussein out of there in the Gulf War in 1991. But again, an Arab nation, an Islamic nation, you can't predict what's going to happen there. United Arab Emirates, for the moment, an ally of the U.S., but neither Kuwait nor the UAE are friendly to Israel, neither one. Though they may be, for the moment, allies of convenience, we'll call it, with the United States. And then Venezuela, we've got old Chavez down there who can't stand us. He's a communist, and he would like to do anything he can to hurt us. So Venezuela's a nation, very hostile. Russia plays the game to suit Russia. And if it suits Russia to cozy up to the West for a while, that's what they'll do. If it suits Russia to begin to move away from the West, they're going to do that. And ultimately, the Russians are our enemies. The Russian government, not the Russian people, but the Russian nation and government and leaders. And even with, it's an amazing thing. You know, when I went to India, India's been an ally of the West for so long. Just very comfortable being in India as an American. Very welcome. Hospitality was just incredible. But in Russia, even among the believers, and we just have made some wonderful friends among the believers, you can always sense that little bit of barrier between Russians and the United States because of all those years of the Cold War. And of course, we have Libya, who's ruled by Gaddafi. And he is once again, he cozied up to the West because Ronald Reagan kicked him into line with a few missile strikes and shooting his planes down. But he's back cozying up to Russia again now and up to the Arab nations, and so he's unpredictable. The European Union is 13th in oil reserves. Now, here's the thing. While we may be 11th in oil reserves, we are way down, and this is very important to remember, we are way down on the list of oil-producing nations because we're not allowed to drill. There is absolutely nothing up at Anwar. the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. There's virtually nothing up there, and you're talking about that whole debate is over a very small piece of land, very small, that there's some proven oil reserves on. And there's absolutely nothing that's going to damage, nothing that's going to harm to drill up there, but we're not permitted to drill. I have I'll be surprised if President Obama doesn't rescind the authorization President Bush gave to drill offshore, because he has made very clear, and it was in his inauguration speech, he's made very clear that he believes in global warming. He's going to go to all that. And by the way, global warming and all of that, all you hear on the media now is that it's accepted. There are only a handful of scientists that accept global warming. But those are the ones who get quoted. Those are the ones who've been put out there by the environmental movement. You've got to understand, I preached a sermon here, or taught on it. I don't know if you would have called it a sermon, but on Sunday nights, probably been a better part of a year ago, on the environmental movement. You have to understand the whole thing of global warming comes out of the environmental movement, and the environmental movement is New Age. It's the New Age movement. And they believe that the earth, it's all based on atheism. They believe the earth is eternal. They believe the universe is eternal and has always existed and will always exist. Human beings, you know, we're here now, gone tomorrow. Human race, they think, will extinguish itself somehow. But the earth is eternal, so we have to protect Mother Earth and Mother Nature. When you believe the earth is eternal, then you believe the resources that are in the earth have to last forever. Okay, you can't use them up. That's what the environmental movement believes. It's all based on atheism. Let me tell you what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that the earth is temporary. This universe is temporary. We're on a spaceship that God's put us on, basically, here. And God's put all the resources we need for the period of time he has planned for us in this world for us to survive. Now, do we need to be prudent? Yes. Do we need to use wisdom in how we use things? Yes. Is it right for us to be conservationists? Yes. I don't think it's right for hunters just to go up and start shooting deer right and left and leave them lay. I think that hunting is to harvest food. It always has been. I think, you know, you see fishermen who are conservationists. They'll sport fish. You see this on the TV shows. I like to watch them, Michigan Outdoors and some of the other ones where they're doing all the fishing and stuff. I don't fish, but I love to watch the guys who know how to do it and do it. It's just very interesting. And they'll catch these beautiful fish just for the sport of catching them, but then they'll very carefully take them off the hook and put them back. Okay? That's conservation. All right? There's probably no more group in the state of Michigan who are conscious about conservation than hunters and fishermen are. But you know, you get all of these people out there, they want to ban all this, oh, we're going to kill all the deer, we're going to catch all the fish, we're going to use up all the resources. It's because of their atheism. They believe the world has to exist forever, therefore we can't use this stuff up. It's better because they believe in the eternal existence of the universe, they believe the universe is superior to man and to human beings, which is why we got to watch out for the spotted owl. We got to save this snail or this slug over here in the corner. You know, we've got to do all these things rather than caring for human beings. It's okay if we abort human beings because they're not going to be around in 10,000 years anyway. You know, but Mother Earth, we got to protect Mother Earth. Now, all of this business about oil is governed by that thinking, that philosophy. Do oil reserves need to be managed? Yes. There's no doubt about that. Should we be prudent and wise in how we use the resources God has committed to us? Yes. You don't want to react to the one ungodly extreme by going to another ungodly extreme, okay? God wants us to take care. The Bible teaches stewardship, does it not? And that applies even to creation and how we manage creation. But folks, if oil is properly managed and these things are properly cared for, this is not something that's going to exceed the capacity that we need it to exceed, because God's planned out the length of time that this earth is going to exist. And God has given enough resources for us to survive and to live during that length of time. So that needs to be the umbrella that governs this whole thing, that all of this is driven by atheism and a belief that the universe and the earth is eternal. Now, the top five countries on the previous list are Arab nations. Together, they control about 60% of the world's oil reserves. Now, historically, all the world's oil has been traded in U.S. dollars. That's been a big boon for us. One of the things that keeps the dollar as strong as it's been, and the dollar's been weaker here in recent years, but one of the things that has kept the dollar as strong as it's been is that the dollar has been the, for a long time now, has been the instrument through which that is used to purchase oil on the world oil market among the nations. But in 1973, when oil prices rose sharply, the United States entered into an agreement with Saudi Arabia to back the Saudi government as an ally as long as the Saudis continue to demand that all oil purchases be in U.S. dollars. Now, here's what happens when your foreign policy is driven by money rather than by morals. When your foreign policy is driven by the desire for financial prosperity rather than by principles. We made an alliance with a government that hates Israel, with a government that has not renounced terrorism, with a government that finances Al-Qaeda. Remember, Osama bin Laden is from Saudi Arabia. With a government that finances Hezbollah, with a government who has people financing Hamas and all these various terrorist groups, we made an alliance of convenience for money to keep the dollar propped up. Why? Because we've gotten so far away from God, we're doing exactly what Asa did in Israel. God gave Asa, early in his reign, a tremendous victory over the Ethiopians, and some scholars estimate that the Ethiopian army numbered 1 million at that time. And the Israeli army was a fraction of that size. And God gave Asa a tremendous victory. And Asa got rid of all the idols in the land. For 35 years, Asa trusted God. Then in year 36 of his reign, he had some nations threatening him, and he went and made an alliance with Egypt to protect himself, an idolatrous nation that hated God. He stopped trusting God to protect him. He made an alliance with Egypt, and God came to him and just rebuked him and said, "What are you doing trusting in man to protect you when I have been your protector all these years?" And then God quoted to him that famous verse we all know, "The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of those whose heart is perfect toward him." That he quoted that to King Asa, saying, "Listen, I am your strength. I am your protector." But no, America thinks its alliances are its protection now because we've forgotten God. And we make alliances with people who represent the devil, and with people who hate Israel, with people who hate the children of Abraham. And we can't expect God's blessing when we do those kinds of things. But here we went, 1973, we told the Saudi government, "We'll back you up as long as you maintain the demand," because the Saudis are the number one producing nation, largest oil reserves in the world, so they've got a lot of clout in OPEC. "We'll ally with you as long as you continue to demand that all our oil purchases be in U.S. dollars." Folks, they've got us right around the throat economically. They can back out on that at any time, and the dollar's going to fall, and the financial markets are going to fall worse than they already have. But the United States was trying to protect its economy by allying with Saudi Arabia. Now, they say, and then we get into all this nonsense. We get into the State Department saying, well, the Saudis are a moderate Islamic regime. They're Sunnis, not Shiites. Let me tell you what, they all hate Israel. They all believe the West is a population of infidels. Who do you think the Saudis are more worried about pleasing? Staying in line with us or keeping all the Ayatollahs in their country happy? All of the religious leaders. Those religious leaders are the keys to the kingdom for the Saudi royal family. If those guys go against them, the royal family is going to be out. And there's going to be another Iran take place. So they'll do anything they can to. That's why they're supporting, to the tune of billions of dollars, terrorism. The Saudis helped foot the bill. for the guys that flew the planes into the World Trade Center. That's been proven over and over again. They paid for them to come over here. They paid for them to take flight training and all of that. These are our allies, these moderates in the Middle East, who say one thing to our face and under the table, they're financing our enemies and Israel's enemies. But note on February 7th, 2008, here's the first step in attacking our economy with this whole issue of oil. Iran opened its own trading exchange with oil brokered in euro dollars instead of the U.S. dollar. And that has destabilized the dollar, and it's not helping our economic situation. They've got a weapon over there. It's called oil, and they know it. Now, who are the top four consumers of oil? Well, while we are way down the list on producers of oil, we're the number one consumer of it. I still remember the Arab oil embargo in 1973-74. How many of you remember that? Raise your hands. Was the odd-even system that, depending on your license plate, was that back here too, or was that just California?
California.
Okay. Yeah. Was it here too? Okay. Yeah, I couldn't remember if it was national or if it was a state-by-state thing. But we had the odd-even out there. You can only buy gas on certain days. And even on those days, you lined up down the block to get in and had to wait. And it got ugly. I mean, you know, Michigan people behave, but California people, they're nasty. And I mean, people were getting in fights. There were shootings. There was all kinds of stuff. And people were losing their tempers because they're in a hurry, don't want to wait in line. They're used to being able to drive right up to that pump and fill up in 2 or 3 minutes. And, you know, that's just shutting us off for a very short period of time. And they about brought us to our knees with oil. China's now the number two consumer. It's estimated that by the year 2015 or so, right around there, that China's going to have over 1.1 billion cars on the road. Japan's number three. Now, Japan's got a real problem. See, if the Arabs try and shut us down, we can drill our way out of the problem. Problem is, you don't build, you don't sink oil wells, you don't build gas refineries, you don't do all this stuff overnight. It takes years. In California right now, that's just because I'm not familiar with what happens in Michigan. But in California, we have what's called the Public Utilities Commission. In order for a new power plant, and most of the power plants are oil-fired, a lot of the power plants in the country are coal-fired, you've got hydro, and some nuclear. But in California, for Southern California Edison to build a new power plant out in the middle of nowhere, I mean, we've got a lot of desert out there where there's nothing, okay? And it's not pretty desert like Arizona is. Arizona's got pretty desert. California is just desert, okay? There's some parts of it that are pretty, but most of it is just dust and dirt and rocks. And so SCE can find a spot out in the middle of nowhere to build a coal-fired power plant. It will take them 15 years and millions, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars of hearings before the Public Utilities Commission and all of the startup process just to get a license to build. Hundreds of millions of dollars and 15 years before they can turn a spade of dirt. And then the time cost of building the plant. And all that money passed on to the consumers. And they're not getting one bit, extra bit of power generation out there. That's what we're up against. Now, most of those plants are fired by oil. Okay? Now, Japan, of course, is an island. They don't have, you know, the United States, at least over time, could start drawing a lot of our oil out of the ground. So we got a lot of it. Okay, but Japan is almost 80% to 85% dependent on imported oil. It all, for the most part, comes into Japan by tanker. Okay, and what do you think happens to Japan? And Japan's one of the major economies in the world. What's going to happen to them if the Arabs decide to put the screws to Israel. And by the way, when we fought the Gulf War in 1991, and General Schwarzkopf was over there, and the army was over there, and they needed money desperately. All these nations had pledged, and he couldn't hardly, the Saudis had pledged, because we were helping them out more than anybody, other than the Kuwaitis, the Saudis had pledged several hundred million dollars to help pay for the fuel and all the cost of us fighting this war. And Schwarzkopf begged and begged and pleaded with Prince Khalid, trying to get the money, and the Saudis wouldn't cough it up. And the bills were mounting in Washington. And he's trying to get money out of Washington, and that's going through the bureaucracy there, and they're saying, well, all these other countries pledged. What people don't realize is it was the Japanese who quietly ponied up and just said, look, we'll start writing the checks. You solve all these other problems, we'll start writing the checks. The first stages of the Gulf War and the air campaign and the buildup there didn't come to a grinding halt because of the Japanese. And so while, you know, they didn't want anybody to know about it, but Schwarzkopf told everybody later on in his book. But Japan has, you know, we talk about all how, oh, they couldn't beat us in war, so they're beating us economically. We talk about all this stuff. Japan's been a pretty faithful ally of the United States. But then we've got Russia, the number four consumer, and that all plays into the Gog-Magog War. Now, the United States uses 25%, one quarter, of all oil produced in the world. The United States also uses 43% of all the crude that's refined into gasoline. 43% of all the world's gasoline. Yet we have not constructed a new refinery in the U.S. since 1976. All it takes to get us in a mess is a good hurricane down on the Gulf Coast, right? And the oil refineries are shutting down and running for cover. We're still recovering from Katrina on that deal. OPEC was formed, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. OPEC was formed in September 1960 by Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. All five of these founding members are hostile to Israel, and four of the five, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela, are either hostile or have or support elements strongly hostile to the United States. The 1973 Arab oil embargo, a move by OPEC to punish nations, and that was its stated purpose. The purpose of that oil embargo was to punish nations who supported Israel. That's why they said they were doing it. 1973 Arab oil embargo, a move by OPEC to punish nations that supported Israel, virtually brought most U.S. households to a near standstill. The price of oil did not go down after the 1973-74 Arab embargo. You would think once they ended the embargo, the price of oil would go down because more supply on the market, law of supply and demand. But what that embargo did is it precipitated the largest transfer of wealth in history because the price of oil stayed up. Hundreds of billions of dollars since that Arab oil embargo has gone out of the United States and into the treasuries of Arab countries, most of whom are enemies of both the U.S. and Israel. We've made them rich. It further precipitated an economic and political realignment in the world. For the first time in centuries, the Middle East became the major consideration in almost every international event, and we've showed you how that plays into prophecy. That's setting the table for the return of Christ. Let me give you a couple of examples of how this resulted in political realignment. You may remember the Carter Doctrine. In his State of the Union address on January 23, 1980, President Jimmy Carter announced that any attempt by an outside force to gain control of the Middle East would be considered as a vital assault on U.S. interests, and such an assault would be repelled by any means necessary, including military force. And the first thing he did after announcing the Carter Doctrine is he formed in the U.S. military what was called the Rapid Deployment Force. In other words, some forces earmarked to fight in the Middle East that we could get there quickly if Russia or somebody came in. There's real concern about what happens in the Middle East and how it's going to impact us, to the point that what happens in the Middle East under the Carter Doctrine is considered a vital interest to the U.S. an assault on U.S. vital interests. You think those enemies of ours having control over oil doesn't matter? Well, in 1991, the Gulf War, every expert agrees that this was the first war in history fought almost entirely over oil. Most people have forgotten the reason Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Right up on the northern border of Kuwait and flowing over into Iraq toward Basra is what's called, I believe it's the Ramadi, something like that, oil field. It's a huge oil field. Part of it's in Kuwait, part of it's over the border in Iraq. Now, the Iraqis wanted that entire oil field. They wanted control over it. But the second issue was, Kuwait has a little island, I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, that has a major oil shipping terminal on that island for oil tankers to come in. And Iraq's oil shipping capability had almost exporting capability by sea. They still had their pipeline over into Jordan. But Iraq's oil exporting ability by sea had almost been completely shut down by the 10-year Iran-Iraq war because they had a waterway that marked the border between Iran and Iraq that emptied into the northern part of the Persian Gulf there called the Shat al-Arab waterway. And that is where all of the Iraqi shipping terminals were. They'd send their tankers up and down the Shat al-Arab waterway. Well, the problem was the 10-year war with Iran and Iraq put so much unexploded ordnance with them firing artillery back and forth across that border and sunk so many vehicles that it's just like iron bottom there, and they've got all this unexploded ordnance, and they can't use the Shat al-Arab waterway. Plus, it wasn't regularly dredged during that time, so as the Persian Gulf flowed up, they're filled up with silt. And so the Shat al-Arab waterway, as far as I know, is still unusable for the most part. So the Iraqis attacked Kuwait for two reasons, or for one reason, oil. But two sub-reasons. Number one, to get control of that vast oil field that flowed over to their border, and secondly, to capture that island which was just past their border and capture that oil exporting terminal. That's the two reasons they attacked Kuwait. And they made the mistake of thinking that nobody would do anything about it, and God bless President George H.W. Bush, he straightened them out on that. Now, how does the oil situation affect the future? That's what this class is about. Well, first of all, it affects the emergence of prophetic alliances. You've got Russia, Persia, Iran, Ethiopia, and Libya. Three of those four are OPEC members. Well, that's the alliance of the Gog-Magog War, the future invasion of Israel, in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And then you have the emergence of petroleum alliances. Let me quote to you Omer Selah, who is an official with the Israel Fuel Authority, and this is from an article not too long ago in the Jerusalem Post. Omer Selah said this, Israeli government official, he said, "The issue of oil becomes more and more with each passing year for Western democracies in general and Israel in particular." It should be more and more important, more and more dangerous. I left out a word there. "For Western democracies in general and for Israel in particular. What we are seeing is a confluence of several negative factors and processes in this region, Middle East. A huge percentage, now here's the problem, a huge percentage of the world's oil reserves is found in the possession of powers not friendly to the West or to Israel." That's the problem. That's the problem. Our enemies consider the wealth and power that oil has brought to them to be a blessing from Allah to be used against the infidels. It's estimated that these countries have $4 trillion. Here's how much money they've made off of us. It's estimated that these countries have $4 trillion invested in the world economy from the proceeds they've gained through their oil exports. They are incredibly wealthy. Can we protect these sources of oil? We're a superpower, right? Can we protect these sources? Let me quote one expert, Paul Roberts, from his book, The End of Oil, A Perilous New World. Roberts says, "But with the continuing fiasco in Iraq, the Iraqi war we're involved in now, it is now clear that even the most powerful military entity in world history cannot stabilize a country at will or make it produce oil by simply sending in soldiers and tanks. In other words, since the Iraqi invasion, the oil market now understands that the United States cannot guarantee the security of oil supplies for itself or for anyone else. That new and chilling knowledge, as much as anything else, explains the high price of oil. So much for the Carter Doctrine. You know what? The Iraq War has proven the Carter Doctrine won't work. There's no way we can protect or control the world oil supplies. No. But if someone can, he who controls Middle Eastern oil has the power to control the world economies and military machines. And you know who's going to control it through treaties in the future? The Antichrist is. That's going to be a major reason he makes those treaties, to gain control of Middle Eastern oil. He's not going to be stupid. If we could see it, don't you think this Satan-possessed, from a human standpoint, genius, is going to be able to see it? Sure he is. You think these nations don't think that oil is a weapon against Israel and the West? Article in the New York Times, Iranian Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's their chief Ayatollah, he said the oil belongs to the people and can be used as a weapon against the West and those who support the savage regime of Israel. If Islamic and Arab countries for only 1 month suspend the export of oil to Israel and its supporters, the world would be shaken. They've got power with oil and they know it. They know it. And they believe Allah has given it to them ultimately to isolate Israel. And that's ultimately the way they're going to use it, to try and force alliances like we made with Saudi Arabia back in 73, to try and with threats, with various ways of intimidation, threatening to cut off our oil. You think with the United States in an economic crisis, in the shape our economy's in right now, you think if OPEC stepped up right now and said, we're going to cut off your oil, you think we wouldn't turn somersaults and triple hoops and gymnastics that would make an Olympian coach, gymnast coach, proud trying to make a deal? Because our economy would be in shambles all over the ground if they cut off oil on us right now. It affects our power plants. It affects the dollar. It affects the financial markets. It is a commodity that trades on the world markets, just like gold, silver, all the rest of these things. You go to the commodities market, you're going to see the gold pit, the silver pit, and you're going to see the fuel oil pit and the heating oil pit and the crude oil pit. It's a commodity traded on the world market. Our economies are deeply tied into this. So what are implications? And I'll stop with this. It's 25 till. The enemies of Israel know the power they hold in their hands with the oil wealth of the world. They've shown a willingness to use this power in 1973 and 1974, Arab oil embargo, to punish Western nations who support Israel before, and you can be assured they will do it again when they feel it's advantageous to them to do it. As the number one consumer of the world's oil and the number one supporter of Israel, the OPEC nations have the power to cripple the U.S. economy and end our ability to help to protect Israel once and for all. Remember what I said, it's all about Israel. It's all about Israel. Don't ever forget that. And this oil business is all about Israel, ultimately. So, here we are. Everything moving right in the direction God wants it to move. See, this isn't doom and gloom for the Christian. We got to get up to the next level and say, wait a minute, this means that some golden daybreak, Jesus is going to come. It's getting close. These are just signposts on the prophetic freeway, the prophetic interstate, saying you're getting close to the rapture. That's an optimistic thing for Christians, but also ought to spur us on to work for Jesus.